What the practical working of these changes will be is already made apparent. On the statute books of most of the states of the American Union are found Sunday laws, and as the agitation in behalf of the seventh day increases, religious zealots are not slow to use these laws to put the machinery of persecution in operation. Observers of the seventh day manifest no defiance of these laws in laboring on Sunday, as the higher law of God gives them an unalienable right to do, and they studiously refrain from disturbing others or in any way infringing upon their rights by boisterous or offensive labor. Yet it is construed to be disturbance if they are even seen anywhere at work, or even if it is known that they are at work anywhere, though unseen and unheard. If no other way appears for detection, they are searched out by ministers or church members, or the police acting under their direction. Then follow arrest, conviction, and penalty by fine, imprisonment, or the chain gang. Up to January 1, 1896, over 100 arrests of this kind had been made, some of them under circumstances of great oppression and cruelty. Fines and costs had been imposed to the amount of $2,269. And prisoners had served an aggregate of nearly 1,500 days in jail and chain gangs. But public sentiment would not endorse such proceedings, and the leaders in the movement, noting this fact, decided to call a halt until such time as they would have public opinion molded in their favor. Hence, there have been fewer cases of prosecution for non-observance of Sunday in recent years. But meanwhile, a vigorous campaign has been carried on by the National Reform Party, the International Reform Bureau, or lobby at Washington, D.C., the Lord's Day Alliance, the Sunday League of America, the New England Sabbath Protective League, and other religious bodies having in view the creation of Sunday law sentiment among the people, and in the state legislatures, and especially in the national legislature at Washington. Within recent years, the contest between the friends and foes of American liberty has been concentrated upon an effort to commit Congress to religious legislation by the enactment of a Sunday law for the District of Columbia. Bills for this purpose have been repeatedly introduced, and one introduced by Senator Johnston of Alabama in 1908 has been urged upon Congress continually up to this date, 1911. Being promptly reintroduced at the first opportunity after each failure of enactment. And the intention seems to be to keep pressing it upon Congress until that body yields to the demand and the decisive step is taken which will give to the cause of religious legislation the endorsement of the national government. That will greatly strengthen the Sunday movement throughout the nation. And the work of securing and enforcing Sunday legislation in the state governments will be much more easily accomplished. At this point, it may be profitable to take a glance at the progress of the Sunday law movement in this country during the recent past. The following are some of the more prominent of the events which mark its advancement. 1890, Breckinridge Sunday Bill for the District of Columbia introduced in Congress. January 6, 1892. Congress orders the gates of the Chicago World's Fair closed on Sunday and decides that Sunday is the Sabbath of the Decalogue. July 19. 1900. Congress makes the appropriation of $5 million for the Louisiana Purchase Exposition at St. Louis, conditional upon Sunday closing of the gates during the whole duration of the fair. March 1, 1904. A Sunday bill for the District of Columbia passed the House of Representatives. April 6, 1906. Congress makes the appropriation of $250,000 for the Jamestown Exposition, conditional upon Sunday closing. June 29, 1906. Wadsworth District Sunday Bill passes House of Representatives, June 11. 1908. Samuel Gompers officially announces that the American Federation of Labor not only is in favor of Sunday rest, but that it has done as much, if not more, than any other organized body of men and women to enforce the observance of the Sunday rest day. September 14, 1907-8. 10 bills for Sunday observance introduced during the first session of the 60th Congress, December 5 to May 1. 1908. Johnston District Sunday bill passed by the Senate, May 15. 1909. Johnston District Sunday bill reintroduced in the Senate, March 22. 1910. Johnston District Sunday bill reintroduced in Senate, January 17. Johnston District Sunday bill passes Senate, January 27. Johnston District Sunday bill introduced in the House, January 28. 1911. Johnston District Sunday bill introduced in special session of Congress, April 6. Favorably reported by the Senate District Committee, May 22. Mann bill for the observance of Sunday in post offices, introduced in House of Representatives, May 16. All this is exclusive of Sunday legislation in the states of the Union and in other countries. During the year 1910, there was such legislation or agitation over the same in California, Connecticut, Indiana, Illinois, Kansas, Kentucky, Maine, Massachusetts, North Dakota, New Jersey, New York, Ohio, Pennsylvania, and the countries of Canada, England, Italy, Portugal, Russia, Spain, and Switzerland. Most of the state governments have in their constitutions or in their adopted Bill of Rights provisions guaranteeing the fullest religious liberty, and the inconsistency of legislating on religious questions under these circumstances is at once seen. While the treachery of oppressing people for opinion's sake in such states is keenly felt, every conceivable invention is therefore resorted to make it appear that it is not religious persecution at all, but only the question of obedience to civil law. One of these inventions is that Sunday is only a civil institution, and its enforcement only a police regulation, a civil requirement necessary for the public good. But this is impossible, for everyone knows that Sunday in its origin, history, and very nature is a religious institution. No claims in its behalf would ever have been heard of but for its religious basis. Hence, any enactment to enforce it by pains and penalties is religious legislation and religious oppression. But if there is a law for it, should not that law be obeyed until repealed? Every law that does not trench upon the domain of conscience, if it becomes unacceptable to the people, should nevertheless be obeyed till it can be changed or repealed. But Sunday laws interfere with the conscience of the observer of another day, and for that reason cannot bear upon all alike. And no true Christian can make his obedience to God depend upon the permission of his fellow men. It may be said again, in a country like the United States, do not majorities rule, and must not their decisions be obeyed? And the answer again is yes, in everything but questions of conscience, but never there. Render unto Caesar the things that are Caesar's, and unto God the things that are God's. Men may legislate to guard the mutual rights of all members of society, but no further. And in this they will never infringe upon the rights of anyone's conscience. For a good conscience, 1 Peter chapter 3, verse 21, will never invade the rights of others, like the polygamy of the Mormons or the human sacrifices of the heathen. The founders of the American Republic never intended that any trouble should arise through the laws of the land over any question of conscience, but they permitted the evil principle of religious laws to remain in their political structure, a principle sure to spring to life at the first opportunity. In the further development of religious truth, it is now found that these laws forbid men to render obedience to what the Bible requires of them, and thus conflict with their unalienable rights. Such laws, therefore, the Christian cannot regard, and the government, to be true to its professed principles, should wipe them off the statute books wherever found. But this the religio-political clergy will not permit, and the nation is doomed, for it will thus put itself in line with the religious despotisms of the past, and the cry will go up from God's suffering children, "It is time for thee, Lord, to work, for they have made void thy law." Psalm 119:126. Well, according to the prophecy, the image can be looked for only in the United States. The worship of the beast will prevail in other countries also, for all the world is to wonder after the beast. Someone may now say, as you expect this movement to carry, you must look for a period of religious persecution in the United States. Nay, more, you must take the position that all the saints of God are to be put to death, for the image is to cause that all who will not worship it shall be killed. A period of persecution has been for about 50 years expected and predicted. It has now begun, and is thus demonstrating the correctness of the application of the prophecy as set forth in this work. But it does not by any means follow that all, and we do not think that even many, will be put to death, though a decree to that effect will be promulgated. For as the prophet elsewhere declares, God does not abandon his people to defeat in this dire conflict, but grants them a complete victory over the beast, his image, his mark, and the number of his name. Revelation chapter 15, verse 2. We further read, respecting this earthly power, that he causes all to receive a mark in their right hand or in their foreheads. Yet chapter 20, verse 4 speaks of the people of God as those who do not receive the mark, nor worship the image. If then he could cause all to receive the mark, and yet all not actually receive it, in like manner his causing all to be put to death who will not worship the image does not necessarily signify that their lives are actually to be taken. But how can this be? Answer: it evidently comes under the rule of interpretation, in accordance with which verbs of action sometimes signify merely the will and endeavor to do the action in question, and not the actual performance of the thing specified. The late George Bush, professor of Hebrew and Oriental literature in New York City University, makes this matter plain. In his notes on Exodus chapter 7, verse 11, he says, "It is a canon of interpretation of frequent use in the exposition of the sacred writings that verbs of action sometimes signify merely the will and endeavor to do the action in question. Thus in Ezekiel chapter 24, verse 13, 'I have purified thee, and thou wast not purged,' which means 'I have endeavored, used means, been at pains to purify thee.' Also John chapter 5, verse 44, 'How can ye believe which receive honor one of another,' which means endeavor to receive. Also Romans chapter 2, verse 4, 'The goodness of God leadeth thee to repentance,' which means endeavors or tends to lead thee. Also Amos chapter 9, verse 3, 'Though they be hid from my sight in the bottom of the sea,' which means though they aim to be hid. Also 1 Corinthians chapter 10, verse 33, 'I please all men,' which means I endeavor to please. Galatians chapter 5, verse 4, 'Whosoever of you are justified by the law,' which means seek or endeavor to be justified. Psalm 69, 4, 'They that destroy me are mighty,' which means that endeavor to destroy me. English, 'that would destroy me.' Acts chapter 7, verse 26, 'And set them at one again,' which means wished and endeavored. English, 'would have set them.'" So in the passage before us, he causes all to receive a mark, and all who will not worship the image to be killed. That is, he wills, purposes, and endeavors to do this. He makes such an enactment passes such a law, but is not able to execute it, for God interposes in behalf of his people, and then those who have kept the word of Christ's patience are kept from falling in this hour of temptation, according to Revelation chapter 3, verse 10. Then those who have made God their refuge are kept from all evil, and no plague comes nigh their dwelling. According to Psalm 91, verses 9 and 10, then all who are found written in the book are delivered, according to Daniel chapter 12, verse 1, and being victors over the beast and his image, they are redeemed from among men, and raise a song of triumph before the throne of God, according to Revelation chapter 14, verses 2 to 4. The objector may further say, "You are altogether too credulous in supposing that the masses of our people, many of whom are either indifferent or wholly opposed to the claims of religion, can be so far brought to favor the religious observance of Sunday that a general law can be promulgated in its behalf." We answer, the prophecy must be fulfilled, and if the prophecy requires such a revolution, it will be accomplished. To receive the mark of the beast in the forehead is, we understand, to give the assent of the mind and judgment to his authority in the adoption of that institution, which constitutes the mark. By parity of reasoning, to receive it in the hand would be to signify allegiance by some outward act. Note 1. For a much more full exposition of this portion of the prophecy, see book entitled The Marvel of Nations, for sale by the Pacific Press Publishing Association, Mountain View, California. Verse 18. Here is wisdom. Let him that hath understanding count the number of the beast, for it is the number of a man, and his number is 666. The number of his name. The number of the beast, says the prophecy, is the number of a man. And if it is to be derived from a name or title, the natural conclusion would be that it must be the name or title of some particular man. The most plausible expression we have seen suggested as containing the number of the beast is the title which the Pope takes to himself and allows others to apply to him. That title is this, Vicarius Filii Dei, Vicegerent of the Son of God. Taking the letters out of this title, which the Latins used as numerals, and giving them their numerical value, we have just 666. Thus we have V, which equals 5, I, which equals 1, C, which equals 100, and A and R are not used as numerals, I again, which equals 1, and U, formerly the same as V, which equals 5, and then S and F, not used as numerals. We have next I, which equals 1, L, which equals 50, I, which equals 1, I, which equals 1, and D, which equals 500. E is not used as a numeral, and I, which equals 1. Adding these numbers together, we have just 666. This title, there is reason to believe, was formerly inscribed upon the Pope's crown. The following testimony on this point is given by the late Elder D. E. Scholes of Washburn, Missouri. I have met two men who declare that they have seen this specific crown, and their testimony is so perfectly in agreement that I am convinced that what they saw is true. The first man was M. de Lati, a Sabbath keeper who had previously been a Catholic priest and had spent 4 years in Rome. He visited me when I was pastor in St. Paul, Minnesota, several years ago. I showed him my tract, The Seal of God and the Mark of the Beast. He at once told me that the inscription was not correctly placed in my illustration. He stated that he had often seen it in the museum at the Vatican, and gave a detailed, accurate description of the whole crown. When my tract was published, I was ignorant of the arrangement of the words of the Latin inscription. Hence, in the illustration of the crown, place them in one line. Brother de Lati at once pointed out the mistake, and said the first word of the sentence was on the first crown of the triple arrangement, the second word on the second part of the crown, while the word day was on the lower division of the Triple Crown. He also explained that the first two words were in dark-colored jewels, while the day was composed entirely of diamonds. During a tent meeting which I held in Webb City, Missouri, I presented the subject, the seal of God and the mark of the beast. I used charts to illustrate it, one being a reproduction of the crown as Brother Day Laddie had described it. A Presbyterian minister was present, Reverend B. Hoffman, and when I described the crown, he spoke out publicly and made a statement to the congregation, saying that while in Rome studying for the priesthood, he had seen this very crown and noted its inscription, and that the word day was composed of 100 diamonds. I met him and learned his name, and visited him at his home, and was convinced from his description that this was the identical crown that Brother De Lati had seen, but which has been denied by many. I then asked him for a written statement, and he gave me the following. To whom it may concern, this is to certify that I was born in Bavaria in 1828, was educated in Munich, and was reared a Roman Catholic. In 1844 and 1845, I was a student for the priesthood in the Jesuit College in Rome. During the Easter service of 1845, Pope Gregory XVI wore a triple crown upon which was the inscription, in jewels, Vicarius Filii Dei. We were told that there were 100 diamonds in the word day. The other words were of some other kind of precious stones, of a darker color. There was one word upon each crown, and not all on the same line. I was present at the services and saw the crown distinctly and noted it carefully. In 1850, I was converted to God and to Protestantism. 2 years later, I entered the Evangelical Church ministry. But later in life, I united with the Presbyterian Church, of which I am now a retired pastor, having been in the ministry for 50 years. I have made the above statement at the request of Elder D. E. Scholes, as he states that some deny that the Pope ever wore this tiara, but I know that he did, for I saw it upon his head. Sincerely yours in Christian service, signed, B. Hoffman, Webb City, Missouri, October 29, 1906. The following extract is from a work entitled The Reformation, bearing the date of 1832. Mrs. A., said Mrs. Emmons, I saw a curious fact the other day. I have dwelt upon it much and will mention it. A person lately was witnessing a ceremony of the Romish Church. As the Pope passed him in procession, splendidly dressed in his pontifical robes, the gentleman's eye rested on these full blazing letters in front of his mitre, Vicarius Filii Dei, the Vicar of the Son of God. His thoughts, with the rapidity of lightning, reverted to Revelation chapter 13, verse 18. Will you turn to it, said Mrs. A. Alice opened the New Testament and read, Let him that hath understanding count the number of the beast, for it is the number of a man. And his number is 666. She paused, and Miss Emmons said, He took out his pencil, and marking the numerical letters of the inscription on his tablet, it stood 666. Here we have indeed the number of a man, even the man of sin, and it is a little singular, perhaps providential, that he should select a title which shows the blasphemous character of the beast, and then cause it to be inscribed upon his mitre, as if to brand himself with the number 666. The foregoing extract doubtless refers to a particular pope on a particular occasion. Other popes might not wear the title emblazoned on the mitre, as there stated, but this does not affect the application at all, for the popes all assume to be the vicar of Christ. See Standard Dictionary under Vicar. And the Latin words given above are the words which express that title in the form Vicar of the Son of God, and their numerical value is 666. Thus closes chapter 13. leaving the people of God with the powers of earth in deadly array against them, and the decrees of death and banishment from society upon them for their adherence to the truth. Spiritualism will be, at the time specified, performing its most imposing wonders, deceiving all the world except the elect, Matthew chapter 24, verse 24, and 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, verses 8 to 12. This will be the hour of temptation or trial, which is to come as the closing test upon all the world, to try them that dwell upon the earth, as mentioned in Revelation chapter 3, verse 10. What is the issue of this conflict? This important inquiry is not left unanswered. The first five verses of the following chapter, which should have been numbered as a part of this, complete the chain of this prophecy, and reveal the glorious triumph of the champions of the truth.